supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. America's attitudes towards homosexuality, they range from benign to indifferent to disgust, and as we know, even hatred. Homophobia is present in many aspects of our lives, perhaps more than we notice. People say automatically, this is gay, or when they don't like something. And homophobic comments and statements are common in our airwaves almost every day. Here's an excerpt from a radio interview with former NBA star Tim Hardaway commenting on retired NBA player John Amici when he was coming out.
People will feel uncomfortable with that. I mean, don't nobody feel comfortable if you're not gay. No, nobody in that locker room will feel comfortable with that person on your team.
What you're saying there, though, Timmy, is flatly homophobic, right? It's just it's bigotry.
Well, I hate gay people, so you know I let it be known. I don't like gay people. I don't like to be around gay people. I don't, I'm homophobic.
Obviously. So what fuels homophobia that we witness in anti-gay demonstrations and violent acts committed against gay people? What really fuels it? On today's show, we'll explore homophobia, where it comes from, and how it gets expressed. We're joined by Faye Flam, Dr. Karen Franklin, and Dr. Stephen Sokol. Flam is a science writer and columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Faye, welcome.
Welcome, Dan.
Steve Sokol's a general adult and child psychiatrist here in Philadelphia in private practice. He's also on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Stephen, thank you. Welcome to the
thank
show.
You.
Thanks for coming on your birthday. We appreciate that. I'm also joined by Karen Franklin, who joins us by telephone. She's a forensic psychologist and professor at Allent University in San Francisco. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Faye, this all starts with you. A column that you wrote for the Inquirer on July 25th about what fuels the hatred of homosexuality. So what got you thinking about that in the first place?
Well, it started out with something I came across in a science journal. It was an article about morality, and it involved a couple of researchers. One of them was a psychologist, and they were trying to figure out why liberals and conservatives seem to have moral compasses that point in different directions. And it was something that I had run across many times in my writing my column and dealing with the reaction to it. So I called one of the researchers, and he sent me some of his other papers. And his idea is that conservatives use the emotion of disgust to guide their moral judgments, and more liberal types, which would probably include me, don't. And he used homosexuality as one example, but I thought that was probably the most relevant one because it's one where there's just a lot of tension in society. So I decided to start the column with that.
Did you ever find out in your research what is disgusting about homosexuality to some people?
Well,
it's a visceral emotion.
Yes, I actually was a little unsure myself because I don't feel that way, but I knew there was one of the world's experts on disgust here in Philadelphia, Paul Rosen at Penn. So I went to talk to him, and he said it is more of a male thing, that men tend to be have a more visceral reaction than women, and that they'd even done some experiments to show that men had a different reaction to just having something that touched another man touch them, that bothered men but didn't bother women.
Steve, from a psychiatric viewpoint, do you think disgust plays a role here?
Well, I think disgust, like anger, is an emotion that's really nice to pay attention to. And I think as evolved people, we want to use our emotions to guide us in how we think and respond to situations. So I think actually there's a lot of usefulness to disgust in helping us think. But using it as a sense of, you know, wisdom or a powerful response in itself, it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, as I was thinking this through and rereading your column, when little kids eat their boogers, I find that disgusting. But I'm not about to legislate against that. You know, or keep them out of maybe restaurants. But, you know, I mean, I'm not reacting to it.
There's a difference, I think, between certain experiences that might be viewed as disgusting, like eating boogers, and relationships between or among people. I mean, I think as evolved people, we need to take it seriously that it's a different sort of experience that we need to look into. I also think when you talk about morality, it's intimidating. So when you use the term moral or moral compass, people back off initially, I think assuming that the person who's using that term moral or morality knows what he or she is talking about. It must be more powerful, let's say. But I think, in third, fourth grade, kids learn about the scientific method and learn about experimenting that is looking at information and not using just emotions to guide their thinking.
You talked about difference and our reaction to difference. Inevitably, and I think it's evolutionary, difference makes us uncomfortable.
Yes. And I think it's a natural reaction to be uncomfortable, and it's also useful as a person to take discomfort seriously. Yet when you take it to the next step and go from being uncomfortable to a much stronger reaction, that's very different.
I want to challenge you on the pronoun you just used. You said when you take it to the next step, and really it goes to the next step.
I disagree. I don't think that it goes to the next step. I think most people feel uncomfortable, and they continue feeling uncomfortable until they can figure it out using their thinking. When it goes to the next step, or let's say when discomfort turns into something more aggressive, that's very different.
Well, I think we kind of agree that people don't decide to take it to the next step. It happens when they don't think about what's happening inside of them.
That can happen. And the people who do take it to the next step do tend to be people who have certain characteristics. And these can be people.
Like?
Like people who have very narrow ideas about gender roles, people who belong to certain communities in which a narrow range of living is valued, people who do not have much psychological mindedness, people who have a great deal of inner conflict and anxiety.
Let me ask you a question just to clarify perspective, and then I want to get to Karen, who's got a broader perspective here. We've got a caller who says it's not proper to label disapproval as homophobia. Certainly discomfort is not homophobia, or is it?
Discomfort is a reaction, and homophobia itself, from the Greek, phobic or phobia, means fear of or avoidance of. Discomfort can stay as discomfort. Homophobia is actually an avoidance. I actually prefer the term homonegativity or homonegative, and that more broadly looks at people's negative reactions toward homosexual people.
It's interesting that he would use the word disapprove, because I think that sort of gets to the heart of the column that I wrote, which is, why do people disapprove of this? I mean, it doesn't hurt anybody. It doesn't cause some kind of unfairness. Why do people disapprove? And so I think that the psychologists were arguing that they disapprove because they're uncomfortable. So they've made this leap from just being uncomfortable to saying it's wrong.
All right. So let's let Karen weigh in, because I think this is might be right in your area of expertise. Karen, are you there?
Yeah.
So yeah, we're climbing into your neighborhood here.
I'm chomping at the bit here.
Yeah, I'll bet you are. Let me ask you before you break out of the starting gate here. You have a really interesting take on the cultural messages we've been receiving for at least, you said, since the Inquisition.
I'm glad the caller actually is distinguishing between disapproval and, you know, disgust or some kind of psychological phobic reaction, and also Faye's asking, well, why do people disapprove? And I think we do know some answers to those questions. And, you know, same-sex sexual behavior has existed pretty much in all cultures that have been studied and throughout time. So, and there's not always this disapproval in each and every culture throughout time and place. Certainly in our European tradition and coming into the United States, there is a real pronounced disapproval, and we have traced it back historically to the time of the Holy Inquisition, when it was deliberately made illegal and, in fact, punishable by death to engage in homoerotic behavior. And I think that's where the starting point is, and it comes down from those European traditions.
So let's jump ahead several hundred years.
Sure.
And you pointed out in an article that our identifiable gay and lesbian culture emerged in this country during post-World War II, during the McCarthy era.
Yes, I don't think that's coincidental. The attitudes toward homosexuality came out of that It was a rigid time period, very conservative time period. A lot of laws were getting enacted to punish deviant behavior, and there was mass roundups of gay people at that time after the war in bars, and the laws that exist today, many of them were most vigorously enforced during that time period. Actually, I shouldn't say the laws that exist today, because one thing that I wanted to talk about some today is the changes that are happening in attitudes, and I think that the changes in attitudes are partly a result of changes in laws, and of course changes in laws are partly a result of changes in attitudes. But in 2003, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a sodomy law in Texas, ruled laws prohibiting private consensual behavior are unconstitutional. And I think that's a major, major shift, and we can see that shift reflected in public opinion polls, which are changing incredibly rapidly.
How so? How are they changing?
Well, you know, the Gallup people, they do polls every so often on various issues. And when they first started asking people about homosexuality and whether it was morally acceptable and should it be legal, back in 1977, so exactly, 30 years ago, it was only a minority that thought, yes, it's okay and should be acceptable way of life. It was 43% back then. Now, most recently, it's up to 60%, which is really comparable with public attitudes toward whether it's okay to get a divorce, for heterosexual couples to get a divorce, and whether it's okay for a woman to have a baby out of wedlock. Actually, the support for homosexuality being legal and morally acceptable is higher than for heterosexual women having a baby out of wedlock.
It's interesting. I hear you say that, and it does make sense, and, boy, it doesn't feel that way. You know, it just doesn't to me. Did either of you have a comment, Steve, Faye?
Well, I get lots and lots of response to my column from the people on the other side of that poll, the people who still disapprove. So I hear, I think, disproportionately from those people. And, you know, I have somebody sent me a cutout copy of my column that says, the Bible is very clear about this. Remember, we will answer to God someday. How will you explain this? I guess because I did something immoral just by opening a discussion about it. I'm assuming, since I'm this person is asking me. So I hear from those people every day. So they're definitely still out there, and they have very strong feelings about this. I think, you know, I've talked to people from a Christian tradition who don't have a problem with homosexuals, and they say, well, that there's a lot in the Bible, you know, there's a tiny amount that deals with homosexuality, and it could be interpreted in different ways. So I think some people will tend to seize on the couple of sentences in there.
Let's take a break. We've got callers who want to join the discussion, and there's much more on this topic to cover. We're talking about, I almost don't want to call it homophobia. We're talking about the roots of discomfort, distaste, even disdain for gay and lesbian bisexuals. My guests are Faye Flam. She's a science writer, columnist for The Inquirer. Dr. Karen Franklin is a forensic psychologist, professor at Elliott University in San Francisco, and Dr. Stephen Sokol is a child and adult psychiatrist with private practice here in Philadelphia. He's also on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, Martyrs Without Borders, a talk with Mohammed Hafiz, author of Suicide Bombers in Iraq. He says the war has unleashed a new generation of Muslim militants who care little about national boundaries and are driven by the ideal of defending Muslims whoever and wherever they are. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tonight at 7, here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about what fuels homophobia, distaste, disdain, discomfort with gay, lesbian, bisexuals. I commented as we went during the break to my guests, language is so difficult here. I fumble with it. We look for the right words, and I want to pick that up after I reintroduce my guest, pick up the theme of language. My guests are Faye Flam, she's a science writer and columnist at the Inquirer. Steve Sokol is a general and a child and adult psychiatrist here in Philadelphia. He's also on the faculty at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And I'm joined on the phone by Karen Franklin, who's a forensic psychologist professor at Elliott University in San Francisco. Hey, Karen, am I pronouncing that university correctly?
It's actually Alliant. I didn't want to say anything, but it's Alliant.
Yeah, please do.
It's a strange name.
Please do.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this business of language. Faye, you had a comment on that.
Well, yeah, I was surprised by the headline that the editors at the paper put on my column, because I set out to write about morality and to answer this bigger question about why homosexuality and sexual behavior in general is considered immoral in some quarters and not others. And then they put the headline, "What Fuels Hatred of Homosexuality?" And hate is such a strong word. And a lot of readers responded to that. They were very defensive. They said, well, we don't really hate those people. We just think what they do is wrong, which is, you know, which was kind of, I didn't accuse anybody of hating anybody, but yeah, the use of language can really change the way people read the whole column. But I think, in a way, if the shoe fits, I mean, these people were defensive maybe because they did hate.
Well, you know, it's interesting, if I may, this is Karen
sure.
again. the issue of hate is such an interesting issue because of the hate crime laws, which presume some kind of emotion of hate underlying attacks on not just sexual minorities like gays and lesbians, but racial attacks and anti-Semitic attacks, etc. And what we find in the actual research with a lot of perpetrators of so-called hate crimes is that there may not be an emotion of hatred. It's such a strong emotion. And oftentimes, especially with attacks on gay men and lesbians and other sexual minorities, transgender people are a real frequent target of attack. It's what we're seeing is that sexual minorities are a really good target for attack because of their symbolic value, not really who they are as human beings, but what they symbolize. And it's kind of a shorthand for violating, I think Steve referenced this also, gender norms.
So let's talk specifics, as long as you're bringing this up, Karen.
Mm-hmm.
I want to comment on an article you wrote in which you interviewed three people who had committed assaults on homosexuals. And they brought together a tremendous range of positions. So
mm-hmm.
you started talking about Brian, a young, white, college-educated liberal who's got gay friends, and he argues against homophobia.
So isn't that funny?
What did he do, and how did that happen?
Right, right. And that's why we can't just say, okay, this is a hate crime, these people hate gays, and that's why they did it, and that's it's so simple. It's too neat a package. Really, it's very complex, and each individual person may have different motivations. But with Brian and with some other people, what we like to do, or what I like to do, is divide it into a few different categories of people who target gays. And one, and I think he fits that, is a social expressive assailant. He's targeting gays because of their who they symbolize, but he's acting more based on his peer group and wanting to fit in with his peer group and wanting to establish his masculinity and his heterosexuality, and it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with how he feels about the victim. You know, it's more about what he's trying to do with the people who he is with.
Well, but what is it about him? There's got to be a psychological component. Almost all young men, boys, you know, have those issues or trying to find their manhood and assert themselves, Steve?
And there's a difference then between discomfort and going beyond discomfort. So as part of, you know, typical adolescent development, boys especially are uncomfortable with aspects of themselves that they view as not powerful or feminine. So they may be uncomfortable if they view themselves as not so strong or potent, really. But then people who take it to the next step by being aggressive to someone to, let's say, somehow in a wacky way, undo their own passivity, that really speaks to someone's difficulty with their personality, really, and how well integrated they are as a person. I don't mean to be too psychobabble here, but people live within a generally narrow range of behavior that they view as reasonable for themselves, or behavior and also emotions and thoughts. If they go beyond that narrow range, they feel uncomfortable. It's when people then act out, let's say behaviorally, by being aggressive, that really pushes it to an area which you'd view as typical to not so typical.
Well, see, Steve, I would really disagree with that, and I hear where you're coming from, but I think it depends what environment the young man is in. And in what we call a hyper-masculine environment, like Tim Hardaway in the NBA, that's a hyper-masculine environment. In some college fraternities and some in other types of environments, it's very, very normal and common for young men to assault gays.
That's
as
true.
Part of their way of expressing their heterosexuality and their masculinity, and it's not necessarily that they're pathological as individuals. It's because they're in that environment where that's what sort of expected of them, and if they don't do it, their fellows are going to be looking at them and wondering what's wrong with them.
Well, I've got a comment as the family therapist that I was, I guess, born to be. It sounds like you're both saying the same thing, that if if you're put in a hyper-masculine environment and if you're uncomfortable or rejecting a part of yourself that doesn't feel all that, quote, masculine, you're more at risk for acting out.
So. And if you believe that the way you're acting matches the way that the people in your community would act, then that also fuels your behavior there.
Right,
right.
Right. I'm hearing Carl Jung floating in the room, who said that which we hate are parts of ourselves, and if we accepted all parts of ourselves, we would hate no one. Let's go to the phones. Our phones have been lit up almost the whole show. Let's start with Matt. Matt, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, Dan. I have one quick comment. I'm a liberal Democrat, and I've always believed that what consenting adults do in their own bedroom is their own business, and no one has any business challenging that. But what upsets people like me is the going to the next step, so to speak, of this gay culture and actually promoting it as a positive good on the media, etc. One of your guests commented that the negative attitudes about gay people was the same, say, level as divorced people and unwed motherhood. Well, I'm going through a divorce, you know, but I'm not proud of that. I'm not going to march in a parade saying, divorcee pride, be proud you're divorced. And I think this is a middle level. People don't mind gay people doing what they want to do, but they're just tired of it being shoved in their face all the time.
Let me, before I turn your question over to my guest, can I try to clarify something, Matt, if I
may? Sure.
I think the first word you used was discomfort or bothered.
I'm not sure. I mean, I experimented with this in my 20s more as a favor to friends than through any desire. I have no discomfort with my neighbors doing whatever they please. But, you know, we don't know in the long run what this kind of social emphasis is going to do to our culture. And there are a lot of people who say, we better be careful here. If we set this alternative lifestyle up as an equal of marriage, we're looking for trouble in a long-term historical view.
Okay, one final question, then I'll stop annoying you, Matt. What are you worried about? What's the fear?
The fear is that civilization and society will crumble, that America will be defeated by radical enemies far worse than the organized anti-gay forces here. We're concerned with the mortar, the cement that holds society together in a long-term view.
Okay. And that's the fear. That's what you believe in your heart would happen.
I believe it's possible. We don't know, but it's dangerous to play with. You know, homosexuality, as your guest pointed out, has always existed in every culture, but it's been undercover. What's new in America, relatively new, I'm no anthropologist, but this idea of just promoting it and having parades, it's just wacko from a middle-class, middle-of-the-road point of view, and it turns people off who would be well-disposed to support the gay movement if they would show a little more discretion.
You bring up some interesting and important points. I know all three of our guests want to comment. I really do appreciate your call, Matt, and I do wish for you an easy transition with your divorce. Take care.
God bless you.
You too. So, who wants to start? Let me start with Steve.
I as far as let's say the gay agenda being shoved in people's faces, actually the government provided a wonderful opportunity for ongoing discussion about issues related to gays and lesbians, and that is the issue of gay marriage. This was not initiated by gay people, but because this has become a huge deal by the government, it's allowed a very assertive response by the gay community. And the issue is that, you know, to people who think about it, gay marriage or gay people showing themselves in the world isn't going to undermine civilization. But what it does is, is show that there is a different way of life that some different than that some people experience. And what it allows the opportunity for is for people to think about people who are different from them and whether they can live in this world with people who are different than they are.
Carol?
Thank you, Matt. Matt, the caller's his position is basically one that's been around for, you know, a couple decades now. It's like, it's okay what they do in their own bedroom, but don't flaunt it. Don't come out. Don't parade around. It will cause civilization to crumble. Actually, it's what's happening is the exact opposite of what he's predicting, because the more gay people come out and the more visible gay people are in various arenas, the more positive the opinions show that Americans' attitudes are becoming, and it's happening very, very radically and very dramatically. And it's things like teenagers feeling free to come out at earlier and earlier ages in high school, as young as 14 or 15 years old, gay parents becoming much more numerous and sending kids to the schools and becoming known in the PTAs across the country, people who have known gay coworkers. And what all that does is it changes gay people from this abstract symbol that I was talking about earlier that serves certain symbolic functions to actual, you know, flesh and blood, individual human beings. And then that type of hatred and animosity can't exist in the same way that it can when you don't know any people.
You are right. I think few in the mental health field and the anthropological field would disagree with you, but I don't want to be so quick to dismiss Matt's anxiety. His anxiety is real, and he's, you know, he's not alone with this anxiety, and there's got to be some evolutionary rationale for this kind of anxiety. You see it, Faye, I'm sure, all the time in your inbox.
Yeah, I got probably more response to this column than I'd gotten to almost any other column I'd written, and the only other ones that could compete for response were ones that also addressed homosexuality in one way or another. And, I mean, when I get those responses where people say, civilization is going to crumble, I guess I'm sort of curious and appealing to you experts, is that really a sane viewpoint? To me, it seems outrageous and deluded and paranoid.
It sounds like it's giving gay people an awful lot of control over.
I mean, we're talking about civilization, our enemies taking over, America collapsing because we let gay people because there are gay people on a television show where they're portrayed in a positive light. I mean,
well, you know, one thing, if we take it out of the realm of gay people and use an analogy, and the analogy that I would propose would be something like Arab Americans. Now, I don't think there was a whole lot of animosity toward Arab Americans as a group, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that wasn't really something in public consciousness. But since these wars have been happening, and with the 9/11 bombing and the terror alert system, Arab Americans are experiencing waves of hate crimes. And even people that look like Arab Americans who aren't, like Mexican Americans who look somewhat Arab. So I don't think it's necessarily an evolutionary thing. I think it can happen pretty quickly, and then it can disappear pretty quickly too. And I think if a person lives in a neighborhood where there are a lot of Arab Americans and knows Arab Americans, that goes to school with Arab Americans, works with Arab Americans, they're probably less likely to have those visceral reactions of feeling like Arab Americans are destroying our culture and they're all terrorists than if they don't know any. That's just a guess. I haven't done the research on that.
I want to talk after our break about prevention and intervention, but I do want to comment to you, Steve, as a clinician from a clinician. And I don't want to write off Matt and his anxiety, and I don't want to be dismissive of it. It seems to me that if we're talking about prevention and moving ahead, we have to understand that anxiety, and we have to understand what it's about and do what we can to help him and the Matts with their anxiety. Nobody wants to live with anxiety. All of us humans do whatever we can to diminish our anxiety.
Right. Well, Matt has a position that's pretty common, as we all know. And the thing is, I think we need to respect that and also understand that there's a response of scapegoating that happens when there's a bunch of people who seem weaker or unable to fight back. And I think that when someone is feeling uncomfortable about the world, it's natural to take on a group of people who one feels is going to accept whatever you take. And I think that's a natural thing which has happened over time. Natural, but not okay.
Right. And it does happen and has happened. That started in for thousands of years. You know, even in the Bible, it says, you shall imbue the head of a goat with all the sins of the people and banish the goat forever. But, so the origin of the scapegoat.
But there's another element, and that is that gay people are viewed as not people, or they're impersonal, or, you know, they are the other. And I think that when people do get to know gay people and accept gay people in the community, in fact, as Karen was saying, that the position changes. And we know from, I believe, GLAAD surveys that young people are much more open to accepting gay people and issues of gay marriage than people who are older. It's not clear why young people are that way, but they're likely more exposed to people who are gay.
It's funny, you know, the treatment for that kind of insecurity, for social anxiety and insecurity, is to open up to the larger society, and everything in our instinct tells us to close down and to protect yourself from the larger society. What we have to do is almost counterintuitive. We've got to use that brain that you referred to earlier in the show, Steve. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation, and I do want to talk more about treatment and prevention, and we've got to take a break. So let's do that now. We're talking about homophobia, the roots of the difficulty, integrating what has been with us forever, the gay, lesbian, bisexual lifestyle. My guests are Faye Flam, she's a science writer and columnist at The Enquirer. Dr. Karen Franklin is a forensic psychologist and professor at Alliant University in San Francisco. Dr. Steve Sokol is general psychiatrist. He treats adults and adolescents, and he's at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
It is striking a chord across the country.
The video game Guitar Hero is moving out of the living room.
Players are taking the toy guitars to the stage.
People think of it as a game. It's really about this fantasy of being a rock star.
A story of guitar heroes.
And has-beens.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about homophobia. My guests are Steven Sokol. He is a psychiatrist in private practice here in Philadelphia, faculty of Department of Psychiatry at Penn. Karen Franklin's a forensic psychologist at Alliant University in San Francisco. Faye Flam is a science writer and columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Let's go right to the phones. We got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Lee. Lee, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, how are you, Dan?
Okay, thanks. You?
I'm quite well.
Good. What was your question, comment?
Well, I actually just wanted to make a comment. I am the legal director at Equality Advocates Pennsylvania, We are an organization that provides direct legal services to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community throughout Pennsylvania. Part of what we do is actually providing services to hate violence victims throughout the state. So we've seen quite a lot of the results of the atmosphere of hatred that's been directed against our community throughout the years. And I wanted to just make a comment about prevention. In case you had any questions for me, I think that everything that's been said has been quite wise about sort of the roots of this, the sort of symbolic value that hate crime targets end up possessing. And I think that one of the most there are two very important things that we can do as a society to combat that sort of symbolic targeting that our community ends up having sort of on their back. The first thing is coming out. I think that we can't overestimate the importance of personal contacts. For many of the people who attack my clients, they don't see my community as people. They see them as a sexuality. They see them as sort of reduced to nothing more than a set of sexual behaviors with which they are uncomfortable for whatever reason. And I think that for our community, our responsibility is to combat that by creating personal relationships, by being out, by doing sort of the opposite of what your caller Matt suggested, and being as sort of not discreet as possible, not being rude necessarily, of course, but being open about who we are, because only then can we be seen as more than sort of a set of discomforting sexual behaviors and more as, the grocery store manager, the mom, the person who lives down the street.
Lee, a friend of mine said to me after I became a quadriplegic, she said, like it or not, you are now a teacher.
Precisely.
Wherever you go, you're going to be teaching. What you teach is really up to you.
That's precisely right, Dan. I think that each one of us in our community carries that responsibility, whether we like it or not, just as you do, to become advocates for our community and to say, it's funny, you don't think of your heterosexual neighbors, at least I don't, I try not to, in terms of their sexual behavior. I think that would make any of us uncomfortable if we looked at the person who lived in the apartment next to us or the person who lives down the street from us and just thought of that person entirely as, what they do, behind closed doors. I think that would make any of us uncomfortable. It's too kind of, it's a little uncomfortably intimate. But when you start to see that person as a whole person, that's my neighbor, that's when you start to understand that sexuality, while an important part of everybody's life, is not the sum total of who I am, just as your disability is not the sum total of who you are. I think the other thing that we have to do is combat the negative symbolic value that our community has been saddled with by creating some more positive symbolic movement from our government. I think that one of the very important things that we can do symbolically is pass hate crime laws that are protective of the LGBT community. We are the third most likely targets of hate violence, and yet not every state has a hate crime law that protects us. In fact, Pennsylvania's hate crime law only became inclusive in 2002. We also don't live in a society where everyone, regardless of where they live, can be protected from being fired or thrown out of housing or public accommodations for being LGBT. So I think that those are some very responsible steps that our government can take to indicate to its citizens that, you may be uncomfortable with gay behavior, you may be uncomfortable with gay people or transgender people, and that's fine, but there has to be a line beyond which you can't cross.
Well, I think what you've said is wonderful, is terribly important, and I'm glad for the work you do. How can people reach you, Lee?
Well, we actually have a website. It's www.equalitypa.org, and folks can go there and find out more about this issue and become more involved if they're interested.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Certainly.
I want to comment on first, Faye, you. What are your thoughts about what can and should be done?
Well, it was sort of interesting that Matt said that he thought that homosexuality was sort of out there in people's faces, because Nobody's being forced to watch television shows that have gay protagonists. Nobody forces people to read my column. So these people are out there looking for, you know, they're looking for this stuff. So it's not in people's faces. And I think that the last caller was right that it is good to have an open discussion, that there is, that can help people understand that this is out there, and that you know, that these are people that have multidimensional lives. But I also have some questions about whether this is really so much a phobia. I find that a lot of the people that contact me actually seem to have sort of an inflated sense of self-esteem, that they have a sense that they know what's right and what's wrong, and that their judgment is right. One letter actually ran in the paper that said, we cannot look to ourselves for morality. We must look to a higher power, after sort of tearing me apart in the letter. But I thought, well, why does this person think that that his sense of morality is reflective of that of a higher power? So I don't know how you deal with that when people back up their prejudice with what they think is a religious sentiment.
Well, that's an automatic way of responding, or a rigid way of responding, to say, well, there's a higher power, or there's a morality to it. What it does is sort of quash the idea of discussion. You know, with gay people, and second thought, it's not like gay people are out there in everyone's face. Of course gay people are out there in everyone's face. You just don't know it, probably, because gay people are, you know, if it's 10% of the population, there are tons of gay people out there.
I want to. You bring up an interesting point about homophobia, whether it's a phobia. Would you label it an accurate phobia, the same as agoraphobia or any other phobia?
Well, no. I view the better term as homonegative, and the example that Faye gives of the person with grandiose ideas, that is viewed really as a very assertive negative response. Let's say in that case, due to grandiose thinking. It's specifically negative, and it's important because many of the hate crimes are due to aggressively negative behavior. Some, as Karen, you know, has described, would be due to more internalized conflictual reaction. But acting, let's say, in concert with what one feels the community feels, that's specifically negative.
Karen, this business of whether it's a phobia or whether it's homonegative, all of your examples, the underpinning of them are all anxiety. And that's the roots of phobia.
I mean, everybody has anxiety, I think, and especially young people have anxiety, and young people have needs to prove themselves, and it's just a matter of how they go about doing that, whether they do it in a way that, as Steve put it, scapegoats a certain other group, or whether they find other avenues to work through those issues. And I don't think it has to be gay people. I think one thing I hope I get a chance to bring it up. I'll just bring it up now.
You better do it now.
We're running out of time. Is a real interesting experiment that was or study that was done in the Massachusetts schools, where they looked at the social climate for young gay people in the high schools and whether gay students felt safe or not in the different high schools in Massachusetts. And what they found is that when they did very simple interventions in the schools, doing some training of staff and setting up these groups called gay-straight alliances in the schools, the climate improved radically and almost overnight for gay students in terms of feeling safe and feeling like whether they were going to be harassed or targeted for violence. And I think it's just so easy to change these attitudes when there's a will to do so. And one interesting aspect of that, and it kind of goes to what Faye wrote about in her column, is whether this is more of a guy thing. A lot of this, what did Steve call it, homonegativity?
Yes.
Is that these gay-straight alliances, who are supposed to be like teachers and students and staff, the majority of the members are straight girls, which is an interesting social phenomenon, but these are girls that have decided that they want to take a stand in the world against prejudice, and they feel that this is a group that's being treated unfairly, and they want to get out there and do something political. And I think that's just such a promising sign for the future. These are young girls out there.
Well, you,
on the forefront. So
you brought up the word that I want to close the show with, and that's the issue of the future. Steve, you start. Where do you see us 5-10 years from now?
Well, I think the trajectory is clearly toward civil rights and openness toward people who are different. I think that's where how people think, because people generally have a very positive attitude toward other people and want the world to be a better place and be more accepting. And I think that's actually the role of religion and community. So I do think things will be in the right direction only if I think the gay lesbian population continues to be assertive, like equality advocates helps the population be assertive to assure that rights are being rights are there and that people are treated fairly.
So, Faye, do you think if you write a similar column 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you'll get a similar response?
I might. I don't know. There's sort of two things going on at once. I think there's a trend. Young people are becoming more accepting and see things like gay marriage as fine. But I think there's also this polarizing element, you know, the yelling and screaming, snarkiness, talk show. So I think there's an aggressive, there's sort of an increase in this public aggression. So I don't know which of those will win out in the end.
Yeah, we certainly know what we hope for. There really is an increase of public aggression, and let's hope that waxes and wanes, perhaps as we do get to know one another more. I want to thank all three of you for joining us. It's really been an interesting and informative show, an important one, too.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests have been Faye Flam, a science writer and columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dr. Karen Franklin is a forensic psychologist and professor at Alliant International University in San Francisco. Dr. Stephen Sokol decided to celebrate his birthday with us. He's a psychiatrist in private practice in Philadelphia. He's also a faculty member at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, if you've got an email, a show idea, or comment, we're at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. And Voices in the Family is produced by Mrs. Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.